Aloha! Cowboy.
Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew, sitting here with Podcat in my lap, awaiting the call from the mighty Oak Ridge boys, Joe Bonzel. Yes, waiting for Joe. Joe is going to call today. Very excited about this show. Every once in a while, I do get a celebrity on the show, and it makes me giddy. Sorry, Podcat, scared him, jumped out of my lap. I know Joe is a big cat guy, and I will talk to him about that and some other things. I want to find out more about his banjo playing. I know he signs a lot of his stuff on Twitter and Facebook, Banjoey. It's a pretty cool, fun little twist on words there. We'll find out more about that and other things when Joe Bonzel joins us here on Remasculate. Here's Joe. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, Steve. How are you doing, my brother?
I am well. We've got Joe Bonzel on the phone. All the way, you're in Maryland now?
Yeah, man. We're in Havana Grace, Maryland. We've got a show tonight at an event called the Seafood Festival, and they guarantee us the best seafood ever. We're sitting right up on the Chesapeake Bay, so I'm planning on some crab cakes and scallops later.
And if it's not the best, what happens?
Oh, it will be, man. You ever had crab cakes right off the Chesapeake? Ah, oh, baby. It ought to be great, man.
It's got to be great.
And besides that, we're doing a big show tonight, so it'll be fun.
It'll be great. We were just talking before I hit the button here. I've got a cat in my lap trying to decide whether to do the interview with, I call him Podcat because he sits down here while I do the podcasts and stuff. And you said it depends on the cat.
Well, cats pretty much do what cats want to do. That's the cool thing about a cat. You know, they don't get real excited. They pretty much live their lives on their own level, and they include you or they do not include you. Now, it's really up to the cat. I've had cats for years, man. 30 years I've had cats in my house. I've had a house full of cats. And I just love them. I love to watch them. I love to. I love how each one is different from another. I love how they just matriculate into doing almost anything at any given time, or doing nothing. But I love that about a cat.
Isn't that what most people don't like about cats, though, that they're so independent? You always hear that. You know, I like a dog because they love you. And then you get the cat people like, no, cats, the independence is the great part.
Well, it depends on what you really like, you know. I mean, every time you come home, a dog's going to jump in your face and lick it and be so, act like he's just so doggone glad to see you because he probably is. The cat may look up at you and say, well, huh, tough time you got home. Anyway, feed me. Hey, listen, I've seen your comic routine enough times to know the one thing cats and dogs do have in common is that throwing up thing.
That is so true, isn't it? There's nothing worse than animal sound of puking in the night.
No, or in the day, but in the night especially because you're in bed and you don't know where it is and where it's going. And it's like, oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, the girlfriend actually got up in the night the other night and there was a foot in something. You know, if one of those, oh no, there's something.
Oh God, that's the worst.
It's something wet.
Oh no, man. I have one cat. His name is Ted. He's a big gray cat, big boy, and he's not young anymore. And when he pukes, man, it is nuclear waste. Yeah, I mean, it is horrible crap, man. Listen to us. We're on a podcast talking about cat puke. But you know what? Most people can identify, I'm sure.
That's true. I mean, that's the best part, I think, about podcasts compared to regular radio interviews is you get to talk about anything and everything. And the feedback that I get is people love to get a real insight on you and the people I talk
well,
to.
Well, I'll go you one step further. In your routine, you talk about how when one dog throws all over the floor, it says, call the other dog, honey, right?
Right. Come here, Kenmore, clean this up.
Yeah, most of the time, a cat ain't going to do that, man. A cat's going to look at it and go, oh, that's disgusting. As if he or she wouldn't do the same thing.
That's
oh.
You know,
they walk away from it like, oh.
The cats very much have this royalty attitude, like, oh, how ignorant. Somebody clean that up.
Yeah, I think it started with the Egyptians.
That's true. They were the big cat people, weren't they?
They were. The ancient Egyptians kept cats and held them in high royal regard. And like the sign says, cats have never let us forget it.
You don't think that the cats are the alien astronauts, do you?
They could be. They really could be, because I think that they can plot, they can plan. I think they have extraordinary intelligence. And they could all cats could be aliens. That may be what takes over the Earth someday.
That's forget Planet of the Apes. It's Planet of the Tabbies.
It is, man. Cats. Yeah, we could all be someday taking orders. Well, what am I talking about? We already do.
Exactly. So, how has the road been for you guys? You guys, last time I saw you, you were here in Colorado somewhere.
Was the last time we saw you when we did the when we went to the ball game together?
Oh no, that was no. That's when I lost my keys.
Yes, I remember that well, but that wasn't the last time
we were up there. You were at
a fair. An outdoor concert.
Yeah, with Eli Young Band and those guys.
Yes, and you were there with Janet, and yeah, that was fun. That was a fun show right out in the middle of nowhere.
That was amazing that many people, I mean, the place was packed for you guys in the middle of nowhere. It's like those small towns, everybody comes from all around, I think is how it works, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It really is. And we do a lot of those kind of things. But to answer your question specifically, the Oak Ridge Boys, man, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year of the four of us being together. I was the last one to join the Oak Ridge Boys in 1973. Richard Dwayne and William Lee were already here. I joined in 73, and I was 25 years old. 40 years later, man, I'm still singing with this group, and I'm 65 years old. I mean, it's pretty doggone amazing. To be honest.
Well, what's pretty amazing is somebody posted on my Facebook, because I asked, you know, what questions I should ask you, and somebody put, I've watched him for years. How does Joe still have the energy to run around the stage like he does?
Well, you know, man, I get asked that a lot, and I've always done that. I've always done it with a pretty high energy level. I can't say that I have the exact energy I had when I was younger. I mean, you just don't. But God's given me real good health, man, And I feel good every night. I mean, to me, to be honest with you, Steve, looking out over the microphone at a crowd and singing and looking through these windows that we look through that are our eyeballs, I don't feel any different behind these windows than I've ever felt. I go out there and sing, and I still feel pretty much the same. My voice still works good. I'm still able to move around and add to the show, add some energy to the show. Again, maybe not as much as before. I probably spot welded a little more than I used to, but... but I still feel pretty much the same. Then, you know, then you walk by a mirror and you go, ah, God, what the hell?
who's that?
What happened?
Well, I was talking to my mom about that kind of thing one day, and she was probably in her 70s at the time, and I said, you know, how's things? She goes, you know, it's all good. I feel exactly the same. I feel 30. She goes, basically the same thing you said, is till you see the mirror that you realize I'm not 30. And I wonder how
that's pretty much it.
I wonder how long that stays like that in your head. Do you just kind of pick an age and you don't go past it? You know, I always feel 25.
I can tell you exactly. I can tell you that answer exactly. It all has to do with health, man. I mean, if you're 35 years old and you've got a bad health issue, then, man, you are slowed down and you feel old. Because it's bad health that really takes it away from you.
Right.
And bad health is no respecter of age. If you're 60 or 70 or 80 years old and you're still feeling pretty doggone good and nothing's jumped from behind a tree to really, like, destroy you, some kind of cancer or heart issues or diabetes or some kind of crap that comes out there and just grabs a hold of you and starts to control your day and your night and your being, then you still do feel pretty much the same. I think health is the key. And if you don't believe that, go to a children's hospital, man. I'm sure you have.
I've done St. Jude's.
Suffering with cancer.
Yeah, that'll get you every time. Well, you know.
Well, the thing is, it's the answer, though, man. It's good health. How does Joe still have the energy to do this? Or even the Oak Ridge Boys, all of us, have the energy to still play 150 dates a year, to play fairs, do a big Christmas tour, do a big concert. It's all health.
Right, right. I was talking to Janet, the girlfriend, the other day about how how people don't take care of themselves. Like if you get a sore foot and you limp and you walk wrong, that affects the muscles in your back, which affects your neck, which gives you headaches, and then you feel tired. It's like, you know, one thing leads to another, and I don't think people really take care of themselves the way they should.
Well, nobody eats right. I mean, I know a few guys on our bus that are definitely with the food police. You know Derek and Richard both.
Yes.
I mean, they're going to eat exactly perfect. I mean, we're all sitting at a game. You think Derek's going to eat a hot dog? A hot dog would kill Derek dead. And Derek's our tour director, for those who don't know. But, you know, I have a little cholesterol problem, according to my doctors. In fact, the last time I saw my doctor, he said to me, you know, you can't just take one of these statins and then still eat anything you want. You have to take a statin and still adjust your diet a little bit. So
I hate that part.
I try some. I do, too. I'm not one of those kind of guys. Like, a big cheeseburger sounds great to me.
Yeah, my dad is one of those guys that's been, like, he's, if I can't eat what I want to eat, then damn it, I just want to die. I mean, he has actually said stuff like that. If I can't do what I want to do or eat what I want to eat, then I just don't want to be here. And I don't understand that thinking, but I do in a way.
He probably doesn't really mean that, but he's making a point that he wants to, that he enjoys eating what he eats, and you know, we're only here once, and I'm going to do what I want to do. I mean, that's okay, too. I think there's a happy medium in there somewhere, though, where people do have to, as you said earlier, look after ourselves just a little bit better than we do. I think everybody's guilty of that. But
could you live on...
But, you know, man, with...
Could you live on the vegetarian diet of just and all that health, just the healthy stuff? You know, the people that are like, I'm just having lettuce and couscous and that's all tonight.
Yeah, see, I can't. I could never do that. No, that's not in my DNA. That's no more in my DNA than it is to paint my house yellow. It's not going to happen.
What do you think is the worst food for you that you like?
That I like? Probably steak. I mean, I am the carnivore, and I do love my meat. I try not to eat too much of it, but that's probably the worst thing I do, because when I do eat a steak, I don't eat a small portion. I think anything's fine in small portion. I got to have a big steak, and I think eventually that may pay some dues. But, you know, man, I like seafood too, though, man. You and I have chowed down on some sushi, baby. We can do it.
God, I love some sushi. Love some sushi. Man,
oh, heck, man, I could eat it every day, couldn't you?
I could live on sushi. But then again, don't make that much money.
No, hey, man, sushi's expensive. I mean, you know, it just is. But, I mean, you're going to go in the sushi bar, and if you're going to really eat real, you're going to spend 40, 50, 60 bucks easy, and maybe 70 or 80 on it.
Oh.
If you're going to really go nuts on it. I mean, that day that we ate together, I think we spent a couple hundred, didn't we?
I know. I love when the boat comes out. When you ever go to get sushi, and they bring out the giant boat. Because it's full.
Yes. It's like our ship has come in.
That's right.
I still have a picture of you and me up there in Colorado somewhere with one of them big boats in front of us. I mean, God, we look like pigs.
Well, what do you say to people that always will go, ooh, I would never eat sushi. That's bait. You know, the standard line. Do you ever get that? Have you ever tried to talk people into eating sushi?
I never have. I always tell them, look, you've known me a long time. Am I going to eat something that tastes bad? I mean, think about it. You don't have to try it if you don't want to, but I challenge you to try it. I was that way back in, I'll tell you the time I turned on the sushi. Our operations manager, John Mears, kid in our office, he's worked for us for, oh man, he's been here about as long as I have, so almost 40 years for John. He got married back in the early 80s, back in our real heyday years. We took a week off and all went to Hawaii, and John and his wife got married at that Elvis place where Elvis was in the Hawaii movie. Okay, so he got married there. We all went. Well, me and my wife, Mary, are sitting with Golden and his wife at the time, Luetta. He's changed gears on that one since. And we were sitting there, and Golden had some tuna sashimi. And it was at a real nice Sheraton, even had like silver chopsticks, and had this like 10 pieces of thick red tuna on his plate. And I made one of my typical remarks. I could hear these rednecks say, oh, that's bait. I couldn't stand the texture. That's a girl thing there.
Right. Oh, I don't like the texture. It's the texture.
That is so true. Texture.
Oh, yeah. It's always women. That's women. I could eat a little, maybe. But it's the texture. That's a girl word. But anyway, man, Golden says to me, just looked up, and you know how Golden talks. He says, hey, man, try it. and he took a piece of that red tuna and he put it in wasabi, a little wasabi on it, and dipped it in soy sauce and put it in my mouth. And I started to chew and I started thinking, no. Whoa, this is great. Yeah, exactly. It's like Monty Python, you know, when the grail appears way up there in the air. And you hear Bible music. Yeah, Charlton Heston music comes on. Anyway, man, I've been eating it ever since. And so I've got to credit Golden. And I think I've turned quite a few people onto it over the years.
I have, too. I try to trick people into eating it. I got my son doing it by... I knew he liked fake crab legs, you know, the sticks. And so I got him fake crab sushi on just rice. And then one day I said, well, you like the fake crab, try the California roll, because that's all it is. It's rice and crab. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then he goes, well, I kind of like that. Then I said, here, why don't you try a piece with the tuna? Boom. And next thing I know, he's all over sushi. So you kind of have to build up to it, I think.
Yes, and so much of it begins with the California roll.
It does, because you go...
It really does, man. I'll have a California roll.
And next thing you know, could you put some squid on that?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I don't do tentacles.
Oh, you don't?
I draw a line of tentacles. Now, Golden Man, he eats tentacles, man. I don't know. Those things with the little suction things on them and all. Golden will slap one of them right on down. I still have never ate a tentacle.
Yeah, I can't do that. I like calamari. I love calamari. But if the whole little thing comes out, I can't eat it. You know, if you ever get calamari at a restaurant and you see the whole little squid, you go, nope, can't do it.
Yeah, that's like, man, I was in Europe one time and I had this real nice seafood dinner ordered and it come out with the head and the tail and all on it. I don't know. I didn't like that a whole lot.
Yeah, I did a sea bass one time and the whole head and tail come from it. It's like, I felt like that Christmas story. Could you cut this part off? Cut the part off right here for me.
Really. I mean, God, sea bass is great. I love sea bass, especially that Chilean, that black sea bass that comes out of Chile. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's what it was. With all your travels, what would you say is the worst thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, McDonald's, hands down.
Oh.
McDonald's just gives me the craps.
I was thinking it was going to be some kind of exotic, like we ate monkey feet once in Thailand or something. No,
nothing like that, man. I'll just go McDonald's. I just cannot do McDonald's. I barely can make it through an egg McMuffin without running to the bathroom. I don't know what it is. McDonald's, and I'll tell you what else I won't eat at is Denny's.
Don't like Denny's.
I don't like Denny's because everything in there has the same aftertaste. I don't care if you have a bowl of soup or scrambled eggs. You got the same taste in your mouth when you're done. I don't do Denny's. I'll starve before I'll eat it at Denny's or a McDonald's.
What about Waffle House?
I like Waffle House.
Me too.
I really do. And I like Firehouse Subs. I love Cracker Barrel. You don't have them out there. Cracker Barrels.
We got one that I can, it's down toward Colorado Springs that I have to travel to go do, but I love Cracker Barrel. And they just opened.
Cracker Barrel breakfast is the best.
They just opened a Firehouse by me. And I keep seeing you posted about Firehouse Subs, and a flyer came to the house announcing that, you know, Firehouse has come to town, and they're doing a Hawaiian roll barbecue. Have you seen that, or have you had that yet?
Let me tell you, that Hawaiian roll sandwich is incredible. They only have it for a couple of months in the summer, and man, it just rocks. And I'm a big Firehouse fan, as you know. I tweet about it all the time. I even get Firehouse Subs even retweet me. But man, I love they got a brisket sub that is incredible. They got a thing called a New York Steamer that's just excellent. And their meatball hoagie, I call it hoagie. I'm still from Philly, but the meatball sub is just to die for. And people say, what about Jersey Mike's? I like some sandwiches at Jersey Mike's, and I even like the steak and egg sandwich you get at Subway. In the morning, sometimes, but there's still nothing like it's so far above the others. I mean, you throw rocks at a Subway once you've had a Firehouse Sub.
Well, I'm definitely going to have to go try it, and I'm thinking they've got to be giving you some free subs by now, right? The way you tweet about them,
they did send me a thing in the mail for some free subs.
Sweet.
They did.
And I'm going to walk in and just tell them Joe Bonzel sent me as soon as I walk into the one over here.
Oh, yeah, they'll know. The people in Hendersonville don't even know me. People in my hometown don't even know me, man. I walk in there and just say, welcome to Firehouse, and what do you want? And then I order it. Then I tweet about it. But they don't even know me in Hendersonville, man. They sure ain't going to know me in Colorado.
You do tweet a lot. Now, what got you onto Twitter?
About 4.5 years ago, we were playing the big rock thing down there in Texas, South by Southwest.
Uh-huh.
We did an Oak Ridge Boys Forum on longevity down there, and we did a show that they taped that actually played on TV quite a bit. And we were all out eating. And you know how young people kind of run the business now? I mean, they just do. Our PR firm that we work with, Webster PR, has just got a bunch of young, cutting-edge guys and girls that work there that just know stuff. And we were sitting there at a P.F. Chang's after we did our big show, all of us eating together, and this young kid, Jeremy Westby, says to me, you need to get on Twitter. Are you on Twitter? I says, no. And he says, well, give me your iPhone. And he downloaded the Twitter app and handed it to me and said, you need to do Twitter. I'll open up an Oak Ridge Boy Twitter account and a Joe Bonzel Twitter account, and you need to have a presence on Twitter. It's very important, and it's going to get more important as time goes by. Well, at first, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I like all of us, you know, I kind of got into it a bit. And now, at Joe Bonzel, I mean, you know, we're not like have millions or hundreds of thousands of followers or nothing, but I've got about 13,000, and Oak Ridge Boys are almost at 30.
Wow.
So we have built it from nothing, and I think that we do a good job at it. Now, Dwayne, and they use my Oak Ridge Boy tweets. They use my Oak Ridge Boy tweets to run Oak Ridge Boy Facebook page.
Uh-huh.
They also pull from Dwayne Allen's Facebook and William Lee Golden's Facebook page for the Oak Ridge Boys Facebook. I'm not on Facebook. I have managed to stay away from that because, to me, everybody, I mean, I can get on Twitter in 2 minutes and think of something clever or funny and do it, or that I think is funny and clever and do it, or informative, and then get off it.
Right.
And those Facebook guys are like, they've got their face in their book all day long.
Right, and it's a lot of negativity. A lot of negativity on Facebook.
Well, you know the greatest quote I ever heard? I said, on Twitter, you get to liking people that you don't know, and on Facebook, you get to hating people that you do know.
That's pretty true. Now, your Twitter is, I love the fact that it is you. And I know that you enjoy the interaction, but what do you think of all the guys that have somebody else run their account? There was a thing going on the other day about people saying, you know, unfriend and unfollow people that you find out are not themselves.
I think that you should be yourself on there. And to me, I can tell right away when somebody's really into tweeting and it's them. I mean, to see like, you know, a million people following a PR firm, that's just kind of ridiculous to me. And I think it needs to be real. I think whatever you do needs to be real. I think you need to put your heart and soul into whatever you're doing, whether if you're singing, if you're doing your comic act, if you're I don't know, building a new kitchen countertop. I mean, God, you got to put everything you've got into it.
That's true.
I believe wholeheartedly in the theory of creativity. I think that everyone has creativity. Most people don't mind it or listen to the voice or the faucet when it turns on. I mean, to me, creativity is holding something in your hand today that wasn't there yesterday because of a dream you followed or an idea that you followed. To me, that's very, very relevant in today's day and age. How many times have you got up and had a great dream and you forgot it by noon?
Mm-hmm.
And suppose that dream had something in it that might have even made a good story. So, man, you should have wrote it down. You get in the shower and you think of something really good, that faucet comes on, so to speak, and you think it's something good. I have got out of the shower soaking wet and made a note of something I thought of, because you'll forget about it later. So I don't care if it's a new song, a tweet, a redesigned kitchen countertop, a book, a story, something you're holding in your hand today that wasn't there yesterday because you listened.
Yeah.
I think everybody has that capability, maybe in varying degrees, but you know, creativity is a cool thing. I mean, it comes from God. God is the creator. And I think he instills that in all of us. And I don't mean to take the Twitter conversation and turn it into this big creative thing. Sometimes a tweet is not really that creative. But yet it is.
No, I agree. I think that you should write down every idea that you get somehow, some way. Because a lot of people ask me about stand-up. You know, how do you write? And I go, I just try to remember what I think is funny. It's just... you have to get up and do it right. Like the other morning, I got up and looked at some notes because I do the same thing: get up middle of the night and jot something down. And if you don't make good notes, they mean nothing to you. If you just write the word green and bottle, it means nothing to you.
You got to write the idea out from you. You're right. You got to take a little time, or else you'll forget what the green in the bottle even meant.
Exactly. I did. I was like, why did I write this? What did this mean to me in the middle of the night?
Oh, that's funny, man. That's funny.
But
Steve, you're a very creative guy too, man. I appreciate you because not only are you very funny and very good at what you do, and very clever and poignant with your humor. I like the fact that you're also a patriot, man. You have very positive feelings about America and where America's right and where America is wrong, and I think you bring that up very well with a you know, encased in humor a bit.
Well, I try to do that. I mean, I'm a very God bless America kind of guy, but don't you feel in this day and age any type of patriotism almost makes people hate you? Because I feel like we were talking about Facebook earlier. I have people that are friends that are like, go, you know, I just can't believe you'd be that like this. Well, what, I'm trying to stand up for America?
Well, that's been the constant influence of these progressive thinkers here, these liberals, man, these people like Obama and his people. I mean, I'd get people mad at me now, but I mean, they're bringing forth more of a idea for America that is not the idea for America that a lot of us grew up on, that our parents believed. You know, my parents were veterans. My father fought in World War II. He got the crap shot out of him in St. Lo, France, 52 days after he landed on Utah Beach. And he's buried in Arlington today. And my mother was a WAC who just loved America, cried when a flag went by. I mean, that's my influence. My mother would go down, walk along the street on Kensington Avenue and down in this neighborhood in Philly where I lived in, and on Veterans Day would buy poppies from every veteran that was selling them. She'd come home with hundreds of these things. And I mean, it's just like, she had such an appreciation for America. She used to teach me that, son, you can be anything you want to be in this country if you treat people right, if you honor God, if you tell the truth, use your talent, do good.
Yep, remember.
Then you can be anything you want to be. But now in this, we live in a day and age now where it seems like everybody says, I don't have to be what I want to be. There's a government check in the mail.
Right. Or they've learned thinking that you can't be what you want to be anymore. Because I grew up the same way, that someday you could be president. Well, everybody knows in this day and age, you and I aren't going to be president anymore. You know, I think there's a weird thinking to people now. They know there's a group of people that run the country, and we might as well accept it. And I don't really want to accept it.
But yet we have a president now who had absolutely no qualifications for being a president. This guy did nothing in the Illinois Senate. He was barely visible when he was in the U.S. Senate. The community organizer thing, whatever that was, is all. He never even passed any legislation with his name on it. And all of a sudden, the guy's president because he can read a teleprompter and he's black?
Well.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but that don't wash with me.
And nobody questions.
I don't think everything he says is great.
And nobody questions where he came from, other than I would hear people all the time go, like, where did he kind of come? He kind of came out of nowhere, didn't he? Yes. Yes, he did. And shouldn't we be worried about that?
I think so, and I'll tell you another thing. You know, the other night there, for instance, it shows you how the press supports him. And again, I'm not bashing Obama here. I'm just wishing we had a different kind of leadership is all I'm saying. Obama's the president, fine. But the other night he goes on Jay Leno. I don't know that Jay Leno is the proper forum to discuss relations with the Soviet Union. I'm sorry, Russia, but he's on Jay Leno talking about Putin and everything else. And all of a sudden he says, and we've got to do something about these Gulf port towns like Charleston and Savannah. Charleston and Savannah and Jacksonville, all three he named, are not on the Gulf. They're on the East Coast. And he said, we need to do something about these Gulf of Mexico port towns. You know what AP quoted him when the Associated Press wrote that quote in the paper, and this is true. They said, we need to do something about these Gulf towns and such places as Charleston, Jacksonville, and Savannah. They added.
Oh, they corrected.
They added that. They corrected him in the paper. Now, had George W. Bush said that, can you just imagine? See, this is the constant double standard. I didn't mean to get off on a political.
Oh, no, I love this, and you know it.
Now we're political. But man, I just think there's got to be some accountability here. And there never is with this guy. He says and does almost anything. I mean, what guy? He got elected president of 57 states, for crying out loud. Well, again, had George Bush or a Dan Quayle or any conservative had said, I've been to all 57 states. Are you kidding me?
Nuclear fallout over that.
So there's this double standard that we live by now where, like you said in the beginning, if you're more conservative-minded, if you're more less government, maybe less taxes, less government intrusion, more personal responsibility, that kind of thing, then all of a sudden the other side does. They look at you like you're crazy, like you're an antique, like you're archaic. But I still think, Steve, that there's still more of us out there.
Do you? Because I'm starting to feel less.
I do. I know it's easy to feel that way if you're a political junkie like we are and you watch it and watch it and watch it. But, man, I got to think these flyover states and everywhere. I mean, listen, the South and the Midwest did not elect this guy president.
True.
We still got a big red South and a big red Midwest, man, for the most part. We've got gigantic red pockets in California and Pennsylvania and New York. The big blue pockets are what elected this guy, and that's where all these people that think that way gather. Well, and they don't really think much of that red. But I'll tell you, if we keep, I don't know if we're going to, can we be pissed off enough in this day and age where we actually get out and do something about it? Will something like this healthcare debacle move the people in the maybe the middle to the right to finally get out to the polls, maybe even in this next election and take back over the Senate? Is that possible?
Possible.
I think it is.
Possible. You know, his ratings have dropped quite a bit. I was just reading this morning how among his own people, supporters, Obama's support is dropping.
Well, people are petrified of this health care bill. I mean, and they should be. It's a monstrosity that nobody's even read. There's so much crap in this bill that, well, you know, you study it, I do, and a lot of people out there listening maybe don't, but I'll tell you what, man, this health care bill is just a dinosaur. It's a monster. And it's going to eat our economy up further. It's going to ruin our health care system as we know it. It's going to ruin the insurance system as we know it. And it's going to cost trillions more to expedite it. So there it is right in front of you in black and white. And I think a lot of people are really looking at this now.
How could they have passed something when they were doing the whole just pass it and then read it? Remember that? That was the whole push on it. Just pass it and then read it because it was so big. We need it right now. I don't know.
We were controlled by total left-wing Congress as well as the president then. And I don't know, man. They pushed that thing through, and it's still a battle. I still don't know what's going to happen. You know, there's still a lot of people trying to stand up against it, but it's a tough battle right now because, you know, he talks well.
Well, what do you say to the people that every time you bring up something like Benghazi or the new NAS or the surveillance and the drone killings and all the kind of scandals right now, they're all going, well, you believe that? You believe, like, how do you not believe it? How are you not following like 7 or 8 scandals at one time?
And he had the audacity the other day to call them phony scandals. Everyone's beat up with these phony scandals and such, he said in a speech the other day. And I think that hurt him. I think a lot of people are going, no, wait a minute, man. This IRS thing isn't phony. This is real. What happened in Benghazi is not phony. It's real. Somebody dropped the ball there. Somebody didn't pay attention. Men are dead.
Right.
I mean, go way back to Fast and Furious. Right now, forget the president. We've got a crappy Justice Department. We've got a crappy IRS. And God help us, IRS is going to be in charge of health care.
Oh.
Oh, my God. Yeah, think about it. And we've got a terrible, health and human. What am I trying to think of? What did that one woman, Sebelius, just leave? What's that department? That's in the tank.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, and the immigration thing, what a joke this all is.
Yeah,
nobody's really doing anything.
The immigration bill, last time I paid a lot of attention to it, was we need to pass it, make people legal, and then fix the border. Was that the last part of it? It wasn't like throw them out, fix the border. It was we need to make them able to stay and then close the border.
Well, either way, something needs to be done. I mean, they're just talking and arguing and fighting. We can't get anything done in Washington. In fact, somebody said the other day, man, I don't think this Congress deserves a month's vacation. I'm kind of glad they're going on vacation.
I wish it would go back to the way it was before, of when they got the lawyers and the doctors and stuff, that they went to Washington and then went home. Remember that's how it worked.
Yeah, was that when Davy Crockett was in Congress?
Exactly. But that's because that's when you didn't feel like government was doing something every day. I think the government sort of ought to be like Windows, you know, that it's an operating system, but you only click on it when you need something. It shouldn't be like just constantly doing something every day, because I can't figure out why government every day is passing a bill or trying to find new legislation, you know, like...
Or regulating something?
Something every day. Why should you pick up your newspaper every day and your government is trying to do something? Shouldn't it just be there to be like, okay, we got these rules in place, the streets need to be safe, the crime needs to be taken care of, food should be healthy, not just every day. Like, you know, we should tax CDs at the Cracker Barrel. You know what I mean? They should just...
Oh, yeah.
It's like they're looking for something.
It's all tax and it's all money and it's all regulation. I mean, this government, for instance... is individually ruining the coal industry.
I have not heard about this.
They're so anti-coal, for instance, and coal is one of our major energy sources in this country, always has been. Now you got these big coal-producing states where even the Democrats in West Virginia and Pennsylvania are turning on the president because of his absolute disdain for coal.
Uh-huh.
That's a little thing, and people don't think about that every day. People get up and go to work every day, and they don't think about the fact that This is an administration that's anti-coal. I mean, who thinks of that, except those of us, again, that are political junkies? But it's just another stone on that mountain of this weird place we're in right now as a nation. And I'm really afraid something big and bad is going to happen.
How?
I really don't think we're prepared for it.
You mean like a big and bad, like somebody try to take us over, or big and bad like Greece, like we just fall apart?
I think that could happen. I also think I'll go even more extreme with you. I think that I think we could lose half a city.
Oh man!
I think these terrorists over there are not sleeping, and I think they're laughing at us. I think they laugh at this president. Yeah. I think they laugh at the whole thing. And now we're pulling out of here, pulling out of there. We're cowering a bit. All right, he's sending drones over and killing people in Yemen right now. Great. I think that's great. Anytime we can kill terrorists, I'm all for that. But, man, I just don't know. I get a little bit scared sometimes of what could really happen in this country, because I still think everything we do security-wise is knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm.
A guy tries to blow up a thing with his shoes, then we all got to take off our shoes. It's just it's a knee-jerk reaction to what has already happened. They've already done it with planes. What's next? When does that nuclear bomb come in here on a freight car?
Right. When did we become afraid to be the big bad America? You know, that's what people respected, where we were the big, bad, you know, yeah, we were the world police, but we were good about it. It wasn't like we were the evil world police. How come we, as American citizens, just went, you know, no, we should calm it down. We should be more like France.
Yeah, well, I remember the Nazis stepping all over France before we got there, if you recall. So.
I do.
And you can do that passive thing if you want to, but it's like my old thing about when you're walking to school every day and there's a bully taking your lunch money every single day, eventually you've got to bust him over the head with a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to do it. So if we've got enemies that hate us, that want to kill us, people forget sometimes that these Muslim extremists want to kill you. They want to kill you. They want to kill Janet. They want to kill me and my wife Mary and my grandkids and slit their throats. That's where their mentality really is. And until we really realize that, and some of our military certainly does, but until we have the leadership that realizes that, I think that we could still be in trouble here. I still think that these people mean us great harm and great danger. And if we don't bust the bottle over the bully's head, I think we're in trouble. I think we could be in trouble. The next 10 years could really be an amazing thing that could make 9/11 seem small.
Well, we've been at
war with these people for thousands of years. They don't change.
That's true.
Go back to the Crusades. When Samson slayed the Philistines, who were the Philistines? It was them.
All right.
So, I mean, it goes way, way back to biblical times. It has never really changed, and I don't see that it's going to. I don't know what the answer is, Steve. Golly, man, I just sing songs and play banjo here. I had a cat. I mean, I don't know the answer. I don't know. But going into Iraq and Afghanistan, was that the answer? I think we did do a lot of deterrent while we were there, yes. We took the battle over there instead of here, so yes. But, you know, then you look at your Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Remember, half those guys that were on those planes that crashed into the World Trade Center and so forth and so on were from Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're supposed to be our friends, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the reasons we didn't do full-out blown attack on them was because, look, we're supposed to be working this out together. Let's agree to blame it on somebody else.
Exactly. And then look what's happening in Syria right now and in places like Africa. This Al-Qaeda Muslim extremist thing is growing, man. Everywhere, if you look at the map where we closed an embassy, there is trouble there. There are pockets of terrorism there. I don't know. We ain't got the kind of military right now to go fight all of them.
Yeah, I thought did you think it was weird that they said, all right, like we're going to close these embassies on this day because we have some warning? Now, isn't that kind of just telling them, well, do it the day before, do it the day after? I couldn't understand
totally
why.
Totally stupid.
I couldn't figure out why you would say we're going to close.
I can't figure out why they would even talk about all of the chatter they've heard. Is that so that to give us peace to know that, see, we listen to everybody's phone calls for a reason? Or is it because they really heard the chatter? Even if it's true, you don't tell that kind of stuff. I mean, that's like letting Hitler know exactly where we're going to land on D-Day.
Well, look how media has changed since World War II and now. Remember how people would, you didn't report anything, you didn't say where you were in the news, you didn't say what was being planned, and now it's all out there. I don't understand how the government does not come down on media and say, shh, hey, we don't say a word. This is war.
All Al-Qaeda has to do is watch the news.
Yeah.
It's right there on the news, what we're doing and how we're doing it.
Yeah, I used to say, I had a joke about that years ago, about the Gulf War, about because they were always teasing about the, those guys were shooting Scud missiles. Remember that? We had Patriots, and they were Scuds. And Patriot sounded like a better weapon, because a Scud sounds like something you'd get on 4th of July that didn't work properly. And I go, they don't really need good weapons. All they got to do is fire and then look at CNN to see where it hit and then go make an adjustment 12 feet the other way.
Well, that's exactly the truth. That was the first real televised war we had, the first Gulf War. We saw it on TV.
Yeah.
And that was the first Bush, even. I just couldn't believe that we were seeing all that. I mean, if we're going to go to war with somebody, just go to war, kick their ass, and come home.
But I think that puts things in people's heads. When they see the war, they see how bad it is, and that's we shouldn't be there. Look at that. That's well, war has always been horrible and always will be horrible. So shouldn't we keep it out of the general public's brain?
Well, I think so, and you think so. I mean, these are things that should not be on the news every day. I guess the first time war really came into our living rooms was Vietnam. I grew up in the 60s, and I remember Vietnam War being on the news every night. Of course, it was only on the major, we only had three network newses, and it was on for 5-6 minutes a night. But you saw our soldiers bleeding and dying on stretchers, being taken away with bloody people, taken away in helicopters. That's the first time I think we really saw war on television. And of course, now everything's communicated, everything. We talk about Twitter, Facebook, that's just tip of the iceberg. Everything's out there all the time. 24-hour news cycles, stuff to fill, you know, talk radio, podcast, everything is out there and everybody's talking. So I don't know. I don't know how we avoid it. I don't know how we avoid that. But a thing like the other day, closing the embassies, talking about this is the worst chatter we've ever heard. Be warned. Well, how should we be warned? Well, we can't tell you that. What? Okay.
We just want to let you know. I mean, we just want to let you know we're working on it for you. That's basically all it was.
Yeah, we're on it. We're on it. You don't have to worry that your government is on the job.
Yeah, that's, you just go back to reading about everything. The Kardashians.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the mentality of America, man, for the most part. Not all of us. But, man, that's where we are. And you think those people over there planning from their side don't know that? The Americans have a short memory. They're going to forget, man. Let's go to the movies and go get a pizza and not think about it. But they're thinking about it all the time.
Constantly. They don't have the amenities that we have, so they've got plenty of time to sit around and plan evil things.
They do. They do, man. They do. Well, you know, you and I've got it solved. I wish they'd just let us, Steve. Shoot, man.
Yeah. I was thinking the other day about how when I was a kid, my entire summer was spent in the front yard with a hose and a sprinkler, and thinking that was the most fun in the world. Because now,
because
it was, and now kids today, if they don't have a video game indoors in the air conditioning and the latest video game, they're all complaining. It's like, man, how get outside? That's why your little kids are chubby. Go outside.
Well, you make a good point about that, and I think, as I recall, last time I saw your routine, your stand-up routine, you had a pretty good little section right there talking about the obesity of kids and playing video games and not going outside. Geez, like you just said, gee whiz, kids, get outside, enjoy the fresh air a little bit. When I was a kid, I was never inside, never.
Did you grow up in the city or out in the country?
I grew up in the city right on the streets, man. And I was on them streets every day, or I was over in the park playing baseball or football or something.
But that's what
I remember my
that's what we did.
Say, my younger days, yeah, I played baseball until my mother called me for lunch, and I played till she called me for dinner, and then I played until it got so dark that ball with the black tape on it, you couldn't even see it.
You had,
because back then, you know, once the skin came off a baseball, man, you put black electrical tape on it.
Oh, I totally forgot about that.
In the city, you had two problems in the neighborhood. If that ball went out of the park and started rolling down the street, it could go down the sewer. And every corner had a sewer, see? So then you had to, like, get a hanger, and you had to fix the hanger just so where you could dip it down in the sewer and get the ball out. And then that ball couldn't be played with for maybe a month.
it had to dry out and get the stink off of it?
The stink, and it would be kind of waterlogged, so it was too heavy.
See, that's
how important the baseball was to us, man. I mean, golly, anybody got a new if a kid came to the park with a new baseball, he was crowned king.
Yeah, I grew up sort of where everything baseball was sticks and rocks, kind of that Alabama song.
Yeah, shard rock.
Yeah, that's what we really did play with rocks. That was our baseballs, big rocks and sticks.
Wow. But we made up a lot of games in the city, man. We played step ball, wire ball, wall ball. We had these little rubber balls called pimple balls. Cut them in half, and we play half ball with a broomstick handle. Hit it against the first story was a single, second story was a double, third story was a triple. But if you hit it off the wall and the guy caught it, it was an out. And if you went over the top of the four-story factory there, then it was a home run. So, I mean, we all played that kind of, we called it half ball.
City rules.
I've never seen it anywhere. Oh, yeah, all city rules. Wire ball, one guy would throw the ball up at the wires, and if it missed the wires and just went up and come down and you caught it, it was an out. If you hit the wires and he caught it, it was an out. But if you hit the wires and it came down and the guy didn't catch it, then that was like a single or a double or a triple. I forget how we did that.
Then
we had a step ball where we bounced the ball off a step. And it would go backwards, and guys played the field back there to get the ball off the step, and wherever it hit would be different, single, double. Or we had so many goofy games, man. In my little backyard, that was about half the size of this hotel room I'm in right now, I could play a whole nine-inning game against two walls, my neighbor's wall up there for pop-ups, and I would pitch against my shed wall and my thing. I could stay out there all day, little Joey, 9 years old, and be the Philadelphia Phillies, the whole lineup playing the Cubs. I could do it, and I did do it. And I say I always wanted to be a ball player, but I wasn't good enough to do that. And, my God, I think I'd be retired 30 years if I was a ball player, maybe 35.
But explains your love for baseball.
Oh, yeah, man. I still love the game of baseball, man, and more than anything. Sitting at a ball game like you and I did up there in Colorado, well, man, that's heaven to me.
Yeah, me too. Eating a hot dog on an outdoor park is a great deal.
Say nothing like it.
Now, let me ask you, because it just dawned on me, how did a city kid from Philadelphia end up in country music?
Well, it started with gospel. When I was 15, I was a hoodlum, man. I was really going on a downward spiral, way away from my mother's teachings and the church's teachings and everything else. And a bunch of Christian kids in the church said to me one day, well, there's this big gospel quartet. Southern gospel groups come up and play out there in the suburbs of Philadelphia. There's a group up here in Pennsylvania called the Couriers Quartet. They bring up these groups from the South, and they have put on these big gospel quartet shows. Go with us. And if you don't like it, we'll never bother you again. Guarantee you'll like it. And my buddy there, his name was Bunky Smullen. He's 3 years older than all the rest of us kids, and he had this white Buick convertible, 1960, white Invicta with red inside. And so, I mean, you'd want to go anywhere with Bucky just to ride in the convertible. So he took us all out there, about 7-8 of us kids. And I saw these groups sing live quartets for the first time ever. That was just, my whole life changed at that show. I wanted to be in a quartet. I wanted to sing in a quartet. I'd already loved Elvis and was into rock and roll and used to go dance on Bandstand and stuff like that. But this was something cool. I'd never seen nothing like it live. So I started going on a kick of gospel. I eventually started my own gospel group called the Faith 4 Quartet. We were terrible. We got us booked in churches and stuff. And me and my sister and two other guys sang for like 2 years. Then I met Richard. Richard was singing in a group called the Eastman Quartet and then the Keystone Quartet. And he called me up when I was 19 years old and said, "Hey, man, we need a singer, man. You want to come sing with us full time? Ain't no money in it." I said, "Yeah, I will." So then me and Richard sang for 6 years in this group called the Keystone Quartet. So we go way, way back, all of this. And my life just metamorphosized into a life of music. I either wanted to be a ball player or a veterinarian. In fact, I worked for a vet for 3 years. I wasn't smart enough, man. I couldn't do those heavy-duty courses.
Yeah, I know.
In high school to be a vet.
I wanted to be a veterinarian, too. That was my goal as a kid, because my dad raised Charlie cattle when I was a kid, and I wanted to be a vet. And then I found out how much school they had to have, and I went, I wonder what else I can do.
Well, you know, in 10th grade, I changed my whole thing to an academic curriculum. And it was like two languages and all kinds of different math and hard math and advanced stuff like that. And I couldn't hack it. I just couldn't do it. I was failing all over the place. So I went out for football, couldn't make the team because I was too little. So I joined the choir, and I sang in the choir. And between the choir and changing my course to a music course and then hearing these gospel groups and then getting my life straightened out with the Lord and then starting to sing gospel music and loving the quartet thing, it just eventually metamorphosized into eventually joining the Oak Ridge Boys when I was 25. Richard had joined the Oaks the year before me. Me and Richard go way back. I was 15 and he was 19 when I met Richard.
That's way back.
Yeah, it's way back. And so there's a lot of water under those bridges, you know?
Yeah.
I wrote a book on the Oak Ridge Boys called An American Journey, and I said you could take thousands of guys and line them up, keep yanking four out of there and put them behind the microphones, and you'll never get an Oak Ridge Boys.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you guys.
Too much water under the bridge.
You guys are the Oak Ridge Boys. I mean, the other bands that have come and replaced people, that couldn't happen with you guys ever, could it?
I don't think so. You know, it happened for a little while back in the middle '80s when Golden got all upset and left, and we filled him in for a while. Then he came back.
Yeah,
and it was never the same. We did good. Even had some hit records back then, but. The four of us is William Lee Golden, Dwayne Allen, Joe Bonzo, Richard Sturban. That's the Oak Ridge Boys. Well, I don't know how many more years we've got to do this, man. I hope a lot. I'm not ready to quit. My partners are 5 and 10 years older than me, and they're still out here. So I think as long as God, again, going back to that good health thing, as long as God continues to bless us with good health, then we're going to keep on singing. There's no reason not to. I remember once Willie Nelson was asked, they said to Willie, he said, "Man, when are you going to retire?" He said, "I sing and I play golf. What do you want me to retire from?"
Yeah, well, going along the same lines, my mom asked me one day. What's that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, my mom asked me one day, like, how long do you think you can do what you do, you know, like the comedy? And I go, how old was Bob Hope? How old was, you know, George Gobel? I mean, you do it as long as you can and you're able to.
Exactly. And there's no reason to quit. And I was going to go on with the Willie thing. We don't even play golf.
Oh, you don't?
We sing songs for a living, man. I mean, to me, golf is like Facebook. I don't want to ever get that involved in golf. Most people I know that are into golf are so into golf, there's nothing else.
It's
total frustration. Total frustration.
It seems like a lot of work, too. You hit and you walk and you hit and you walk and it's hot and you look for your ball and walk some more.
Yeah, that's the part of it I'd probably kind of like, though, because it is nice and quiet and all, but that's why Band Joey has his farm. I go out to my farm that I own on the Kentucky-Tennessee line, and it's quiet out there, man. Nearest neighbor's 3 miles away. I mean, bad for having a heart attack, but great if you just want to be by yourself. Cut grass, weed eat, shoot guns.
Oh, so you're a gun
take
guy.
Long walks.
You're a gun guy?
Oh, man, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Do you have your concealed?
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Oh, yeah. I'm a gun guy all the way. I fall down all on the positive side of gun ownership and concealed carry, definitely.
Oh, good. You brought up something a while ago about the city and the country, and it made me think about the gun thing, and I was going to bring it up. I had somebody, when I read Facebook, and I had people like, why do they need guns? What do you need guns for? Can't we just get rid of them? And I always look to see where they're from on Facebook. And you get a lot of East Coast, West Coast people that don't like and don't understand guns. And I think people that don't know what you do with them don't understand them. You know, like, I grew up hunting with guns. I grew up shooting varmints that were in the barn with guns. You know, you protect your home. And I think city people only think of guns as things for crime. Do you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. And having come from the city, I can see that. But the thing that's important to realize here is that with all these gun laws and everything else, is the bad guys always get guns. They can find them. They can get them. I can get any gun I want right now online, to be honest with you, without any problem at all. Don't even have to register it. There are websites out there where gun guys just sell guns to other gun guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they talk about an AR-15 that happened in the Colorado shooting up there. I was looking on a website just today and saw two Bushmaster AR-15s for sale. And it's not a problem, anybody getting a gun. But I think that if people are serious about firearms, that they should study them. They should know what they're doing. They should know how they work and how to clean them. They should take classes. And, of course, concealed carry, you've got to take a lot of classes. So they should educate themselves. I mean, just willy-nilly having a gun around or somebody who's especially unstable is not good, because most of the things that happen bad with guns happen with either criminals or unstable people.
Mentally. Right.
Should not have a gun around. And nobody's done nothing about that. I'll give you a cool stat here. The United States is third in the world in murders. If you take out New York, Chicago, New Orleans, there's one more. I know it's New York, Chicago, New Orleans, and there's one other city. If you take them out of the equation, we're next to last.
I know Detroit's high up there. I don't know if that's the one you're thinking of, but
Detroit. And those four cities have the most stringent gun laws on the books of anywhere else.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you right there. There's proof in the pudding that gun talk that comes out of the left side, progressive side, is not correct.
I totally agree. The laws are for the law-abiding citizens. It's like, you know, breaking into a house is against the law. Good people don't break into a house. It's the lawbreakers are going to do it no matter what a law is, for any law.
Let me tell you, Banjoey here is armed at 90% of the time. I've always got either a very small weapon somewhere, usually two. And nobody is in any danger of getting shot by me.
What do you?
It's not going to happen.
What do you carry? I have a concealed 380. That's what I carry most of the time.
Mm-hmm. I keep either a Kar 9mm or a Glock Mini 40 on my ankle, and in my pocket I've got an American made what they call a 22 Magnum Pug.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most powerful little gun you have ever seen. Yank back on the hammer and shoot that thing, and you will just literally will not believe what a 22 Magnum of this magnitude can do. It's really got a lot of firepower for such a small gun, and it's in my pocket all the time. It's in my pocket at home.
Well, I took my concealed weapons class from a guy that's a Denver SWAT cop, and he actually was talking about the power of a 22, because everybody wants all these, you know, a 40 or a 44, these big guns, and he goes,
right.
Accuracy with a 22 is all you need for protection.
And this little gun I carry in my pocket is a 22 mag, made by American Firearms. Look it up online. It's called a Pug. It's an amazing little gun.
I will definitely check it out. It's surprising to hear that there might be two. A friend of mine named David Lucas, who's a comic magician, used to work for Liberace. He actually carries two guns all the time, one on his ankle and one strapped in a holster in his back. And I always thought it was odd. Like, isn't one going to be enough? And he goes, you never know. You just never know.
Well, when I go downtown Nashville, I always have two. I usually sometimes three. I'll have my Glock 40 on my ankle, mini Glock 40, and I'll have my Kar 9mm in my back, and I'll have my 22. It's like the cop pulls you over, you know, and you say, sir, I've got a concealed carry permit. I think you should know I've got seven guns in the car. He says, what are you afraid of? Nothing.
Nothing. I'm right now, nothing.
But yeah, you know the old cow. Straight up, boy. Not a thing, sir. Not a thing.
Well, let me ask you. We're about an hour, and this is what I was going to wrap you up on, but you got me on a question because we both carry, and I was talking to another friend that carries the other day. This whole Trayvon Martin thing has gotten people, I think, worried about what you would actually do in protection. You know, even if you saw a crime, does it make you second guess yourself about trying to stop it because of all the crap you'll have to go through, even more now? I always understood that there would be trouble. You know, you'd have to go and figure out and explain what happened, and there might be court dates. But now it looks like if you try to protect yourself or somebody else, it's going to be hell. So
let me tell you something. And they taught us this in class. If you get in a gunfight of any kind, if you use your gun, you're going to be in trouble. I don't care if you're totally justified or not.
Right.
A concealed carry is not going to keep you out of trouble. You're going to have to answer questions. You're going to have to go to court. You could even be charged with all kind of stuff. And that's what happened in Trayvon Martin thing. So you've got to realize and you've got to know. You know, if I'm in my house and I see a guy break into my car and steal all my CDs out of there or something, and he's running, I can't pull a gun and shoot that guy.
That's right.
You can only draw down if your life is in imminent danger. If he draws a weapon or if he's coming at you with a baseball bat, you can shoot the daylights out of him. But until he does that, you do not have the right to take his life. And there's a lot of interesting things right there. If you feel you're in danger, of course, you got to do what you feel is right and then let God sort it out later. My thing is, if you don't have a gun at all, you're doomed.
Exactly.
I want to have a chance when the loon opens fire in Kroger. That's why I carry. If the crazy guy gets up in the movie theater and starts shooting, that don't mean having a gun is going to save Joe Bonzel. I may be the first to go and those around me. But without it, I have no chance at all. Interesting tweet way back when the Colorado, and you're close to this, thing happened and the guy broke out the AR-15 at the Batman movie and started shooting people. Most of those people were on the floor chewing carpet. Nobody was doing anything. They were sitting ducks to this guy.
Right.
And my point was, if one guy had a firearm, one guy, he might could have stood up and taken this guy out. He might could have saved some lives.
Yeah, even an
armed guy with a firearm.
Yeah, everybody's talking about he had protection on, but just one guy with a good shot could have armed him, or one in the arm, one in the leg, just something to slow him down.
One guy with training, one guy with a gun, one off-duty cop, something. And then you know what somebody tweeted when I said that on Twitter? You know what somebody came back and said? Yeah, but you've got to know that there's a no firearms allowed sign on the front of that movie theater.
Yes, there is.
Oh, well, there you go. There's your answer.
Yes. When
it didn't deter the criminal, though, did it?
When
it didn't deter the criminal. He came in with it.
What? That's why we need more laws. Oh, man. Well, I appreciate you coming
on.
Well,
I'll never forget the big cop that gave me a lesson, too. You know, so if you go to a place and there's a no firearm sign, you got to put your gun in the glove compartment. And I says, well, you know, like, I know where there's a Walmart that doesn't have that sign, and I know where there's one that does. He says, well, let's look at it this way. And I didn't tell you this. I'm a real big guy, and I carry a real small gun. I ain't putting mine in the glove compartment.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Just protect yourself at all times.
So, in other words, I got to tell you, I go to the movies, and that sign's on the door. You might as well arrest me now, those that are here in this podcast, because Banjoey's still going to have his firearm with him.
God bless America and Banjoey.
There you go, man. There you go. We have solved God. And again, keeping in mind, oh, comic friend, that this whole podcast started with cat puke.
It did. And we ended up went from cat puke to solving the world's problems.
We have solved them all, man. Just me and you. You there in Colorado and me in a hotel room in Haverty Grace, Maryland, looking forward to eating crab cakes and singing songs tonight.
Ah, and it will be one of the best shows ever. Because now look at you're in a good mood today, aren't you?
I am. I feel great. Well, I appreciate you, Steve. I appreciate your friendship, your support, and you've always kind of been there for us and for me. And
I
think you're one of the good guys. You're one of the good guys out there, man. And besides that, you're really, really funny.
Thank you very much. And I'm an Oaks fan and have been forever. That you've known that, and that's one of the way I sign off the podcast is God bless America and go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys.
I know, man. I know you do, and I appreciate that. We all do. And do me a favor and give my best to Janet, who calls herself Pink Barb for whatever reason that is.
Pink Barb 27. That's her Twitter handle. That's because her favorite color is pink, and when she was a kid, her favorite doll was Barbie. Those are the. I had to ask her that reason too.
Yeah, I think she told me that too. I think she might have told me that the day at the ball game. I think I asked her, "What's with the pink Barb?"
Well, she's out. We may try to make it. I know you guys are coming to the Colorado State Fair down in Pueblo.
Yeah, that's going to be a weird one right there. That we've got a really weird schedule there for a little bit. We've got four big fairs to play without the bus. We're going to fly out west and do the Washington State Fair, the Evergreen State Fair, and the Oregon State Fair. Then we've got to fly to Colorado and do that fair, and then fly to Ohio and get on the bus and start doing some more fairs. It's about a 12-day trip altogether. We're out without the bus for 5 days. Then we rejoin the bus. So
yeah,
we got some rough tripping right there. And I'll tell you what else. We just booked a private show in Denver.
Oh, you
did? I forget what it's for, but it's a private show, and it ain't till sometime, I don't know, October or something. We're in Biloxi, Mississippi. We're flying up there to do a private show. And I was going to let you know about that, so come hang.
Oh, yeah, if you're closer, yeah, if you got enough time, we'll go eat sushi somewhere.
I'm planning on it, if you're there.
Well, yeah, definitely holler at me, and we'll figure it out. I had so many other questions and topics that I wanted to talk about with you. You want to do this again sometime?
I think we should, Steve, and I really appreciate you having me on. It's an honor to talk to you. Like I said, I appreciate you a lot, and I thank you for having me on your podcast, and I'd love to do it anytime. We'll do it again, cover some other ground if you want to. I knew this would happen. We'd just get talking if we weren't on a podcast.
Well, I know I sent you the email, but do you have anything you want to talk about? You go, well, let's just start talking and see how it goes. I love that. So we will do it again and solve some more of the world's problems. Joe,
Follow me at Joe Bonzel, at Joe Bonzel on Twitter, JoeBonsall. Follow OakRidgeBoys.com.
Uh-huh.
And for all things Oak Ridge Boys, and there's my plug of the day.
Well, is there a tour? Do y'all have an Oak Ridge site for tour dates, or should they just contact you?
Oh, yeah, man. OakRidgeBoys.com. It's all there.
All right. Joe, thanks for coming on with me.
There.
I appreciate it, and thanks for solving the world's problems. We'll see
you. All right, man. Love you, brother.
Love you, too. See ya. That's it. God bless America, and go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. I bid you adieu.
In the basement of the mud flap house, flapping and poo, and their underwear, thing raising noose, and poo licks herself, and flap contemplates manly things. He thinks about guns and trucks and stooges three, men and boys, and that doesn't sound right. He thinks about booze and bacon and power tools. Come with me, let your mask you leave. Oh, won't you come with me and remind?